supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Hey, if you think mental illness is about someone else, think again. Every year, 57 million Americans are diagnosed with a severe mental illness, such as schizophrenia, depression, or bipolar disorder. And when you think about family, friends, co-workers of those 57 million, almost all of us have been touched by mental illness. Well, what does life look like with mental illness? And what does recovery mean? And what makes it possible? On today's show, we'll talk with three psychiatrists about research, treatment, and long-term recovery. Our first guest is Dr. Philip Wang. He's the director of the Division of Services and Intervention Research at the National Institute of Mental Health. Dr. Wang's a graduate of Harvard Medical School, and by the way, he's one of the leading researchers in services and pharmacoepidemiology, and we're going to hear more about that in a few minutes. Dr. Wang, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan. Happy to be here.
So, I want to talk to you about genetics. You know, when I was in graduate school in the 60s, we knew the cause for every mental illness. It was the mother. There was the schizophrenogenic mother, the refrigerator mother, the incestuous mother, and the neurotic mother. So hopefully we've come away since then. Now it's genetics is indicted in almost all mental illness.
Well, you refer to probably a period that is an unfortunate one in which mothers were unduly sort of suspected as being sort of the cause. You know, at the moment, the genetics, as you mentioned, is a promising area. There have been developments even as recently as this month. Francis McMahon scanned all of the variation in the human genes and found some that are associated with bipolar disorder. There's certainly promise in that could be used, that information could be used to develop new treatments to target, sort of the products of those genes. But, one thing probably I think you were raising or maybe cautioning is, genes probably aren't going to be everything. Previous hoped for, causes didn't turn out to be the entire story. Genes probably certainly play a role. And again, could lead to some promising treatments, but again, probably other factors are involved in, the etiology and the cause of mental illness.
Well, my lens as a clinician is quite different from yours as a researcher. And one of the things I like about the genetics and working with patients is number one, it takes away a lot of shame and blame. And number two, if you're going to be angry at your parent for their behavior towards you, so be it. But, you can be angry at their genes, too.
Sure. I think, at the Institute here, the National Institute of Mental Health, we are always eager to point out that these are brain disorders because they do get out of this, as you mentioned, this era of, sort of blaming mothers and that sort of thing, that it does remove it from that. These are actual medical disorders.
You said genes are part of the story. There's lots of other factors with these brain disorders. And tell us what some of the others are that you're looking at.
Well, there's a lot of research to look at. Certainly the environment plays a role, and a very interesting, promising area is looking at how the environment actually interacts with genes. In other words, they are often their relationships between your circumstances and your actual genetic predispositions, and the relationships can end up being very complicated, but that's a very promising area of research.
For example, explain that. We've learned that environment can change the brain. We know childhood trauma actually affects a child's brain. But how does environment affect genes?
Well, you raised one of the clearest examples where you can actually see, you know, changes in the brain based on experiences, you know, one's environment. Others, you know, there are things in the environment that for example, the season, and, you know, your likelihood of potentially being maybe exposed to infectious agents. It looks like the season of your birth, for example, might be related to developing schizophrenia. That's another example.
Wow.
Nutrition may play a role as well. You know, there are a number of things in one's environment that play a role. Again, the relationships at the end of the day will end up probably being, you know, far more complex than you know, just sort of some simple relationship. But this is a promising area of research to try to uncover these complex relationships.
I want to come back to this piece of research you just cited that just got published about the genetics of bipolar disorder and the hope that brings for targeted medication. How are we doing with targeting medication?
Well, that's another, you know, very promising area of research, you know, to figure out, you know, I mean, it starts with understanding what the underlying basis is for these illnesses, but then developing treatments that actually are what we call personalized, you know, that they take into account your, not just your, you know, genes, but the other factors about you that might, you know, influence what the right treatment should be. So, for example, your family history or your prior experience on a treatment. You know, the goal would be to take all that kind of information and maybe also some of the other conditions you have, general medical conditions, this sort of thing, into account and get you the best treatment, the optimal treatment. And that's another area that where, you know, a considerable amount of research is occurring, is to help personalize treatment.
How are we doing so far? Do we have anything on the market that's more targeted?
Well, you know, that there's, again, another recent development. You know, the NIMH has been supporting these very large-scale, what we call practical clinical trials that are meant to study typical patients in real-world settings and are intended to answer questions that our current, you know, practicing clinicians would be dilemmas for them. They don't know which is the right sequence of treatments to try or what to do after someone fails a particular regimen. And in one of these trials is called STAR-D. It's a trial of treatments for depression. And in it, there actually was a component that drew bloods on people and determined their genetic makeup. And there's interesting results that have been emerging suggesting which patients you know, may be more responsive to antidepressant treatments than not. So that's the kind of research I'm talking about.
Can you give us some insights into that?
Well, there was one interesting finding, you know, that African Americans, for example, were less likely to respond to these, you know, sort of commonly used antidepressant treatments, and it sort of points the direction for certainly the development of new treatments. You know, and for you know, African American populations.
Speaking of depression, there's obviously a great deal of concern about suicide, and we know that almost all suicides are done by people who are depressed, but only a small minority of people who are depressed commit suicide. So, So what's the difference? What's happening with that relatively small subset of people?
Well, you know, depression is, you know, certainly being depressed is a very, very strong risk factor, and as you say, but not everyone who commits suicide is you know, depression isn't the only thing that determines that. Obviously, you know, there are other things that can play a role. For example, alcohol and substance use, you know, also very often play a role. And then in many cases, there is no understanding of exactly what, you know, was sort of behind someone, you know.
What about age? Is age a risk factor?
Yeah, it is. You know, age, older men are, you know, a very high risk group. So yeah, there's some we know about. You know, there are factors that might, you know, place someone at a higher risk. But at the end of the day, you know, this very tragic act is not something that we could predict necessarily well.
I want to come back to my introduction of you, your skills with pharmacoepidemiology. And if I understand it, it's going to address which populations, which cultures are going to respond better to which treatments?
Well, some of it is actually studying how medications do in the real world. Some of it is actually your introduction, I think, was very nice in pointing out that one of the areas for research, at least my own background, was in looking at the burdens of mental illness and how to reduce them through treatment, through improving the use of existing treatments, increasing access to services. That's another area that we sort of take on as kind of a part of the discipline.
What is out there? This is going to be a big global question, but what's out there for someone with a major mental disorder, someone with, say, schizophrenia or is dysfunctional with bipolar disorder? We have medication, we have psychotherapy, I guess we have hospitalization.
There's a very interesting line of research, and it gets at this this issue of how do you as in your opening stated, how do you improve recovery? You know, that there's clearly a lot of burden from these serious mental illnesses, and the burdens are, come up because they're very common conditions, as you said. They strike you earlier than many other, chronic diseases. These strike you in your teens, in your, 20s. And then they disrupt your life. They disrupt your ability to function, your ability to work. And so they end up being very, very costly on a personal and a societal basis. One of the unfortunate reasons why, these burdens are so large is because even though there are effective treatments for many of these conditions, they're not used. And so, the latest epidemiologic data we have suggests that if you have an active mental disorder, less than half of people have gotten any form of care in the prior year. And even of those who've gotten care, it's very often, it's not health care. And, we don't know much about how effective or not effective these are. And even people who get health care, what we're learning is they very often get regimens that are either inappropriate or not very intensive. And so very, very few people with, these serious mental illnesses are actually getting treatment where they could potentially benefit. So this promising avenue of research I was alluding to is in the services research arena, where we, there are a number of models that people are developing where they use, for example, allied health personnel to essentially help manage patients' care and help them initiate treatments if they haven't started one. Outreach, just to even get them to, some of it is even just letting them know what the mental illness is. And then once they are in treatment, helping them, monitor how they're doing, helping them adhere to regimens, which very often, a lot of these regimens are hard to stick with. And the evaluations, the research of these models show that they're very effective. They're very effective. They're also very cost effective. So this is one promising line of research that we hope will get at what I think you were calling for, which is how do we improve the recovery, the ability of people with serious mental illness to recover and lead productive lives.
Well, hopefully we're going to hear more about such programs in the second part of the show, but I can't let you go without asking two questions, and one is about drugs with children, medication with children. I've got to ask it. And the other's about autism. So let's start with medication and children. FDA just changed their warning label.
Mm-hmm. Yes. There had been a warning, and I guess it was the initial warning was that some people initiated on an antidepressant might develop suicidal thoughts, suicidal behaviors, and that clinicians who start patients should monitor their patients who've started an antidepressant. The most recent data that the FDA based their regulatory action on showed that it looks like the risk is mainly in younger in children and younger adults, and that it looks like in older adults that this relationship didn't necessarily hold. So that's why their warning was essentially made more specific to children, adolescents, younger adults.
And of course, it's a hard call for a clinician and a parent, because depression is a brain disorder, and left untreated, you're harming your brain.
Exactly. It's a very, it's a decision that you hope is, made thoughtfully, because, as you put it, the disorders themselves are very high risk factors, very strong risk factors for self-harm, and the treatments, themselves can be very helpful. And so you have to make your decision carefully, weighing these, what may be a risk in younger children, in children and adolescents, versus the potential benefits. And again, the real important thing here is, some of this can be, if there is a risk in some, it can be averted via close monitoring. So the thing that you could do is, if someone is started, as a clinician, as a parent, as a patient, is monitoring, make sure that any emergence of any suicidal thoughts or behaviors is actually picked up and caught.
I said I had two questions before I let you go. The second one is autism. One in every 150. It's touching an awful lot of lives in our country these days. What are we learning? What are we learning about causes and treatments? Moreover, from a political perspective, Philip, how much money do you have to study autism, and how much money do you anticipate coming in?
Well, this past year, the Congress actually passed an autism act, where there actually now are actual resources, specifically earmarked for an autism initiative to increase research into this illness, which, as you point out, is common, and is maybe more common than people have thought, and it's exactly what the causes, the etiologies. We need to do a lot of research to find that out, and also find improved treatments. There's a lot of work to be done, and there's actual now resources committed by the Congress in this area.
What do we know?
It's a much longer conversation, okay. Probably.
Let me ask you that. This, if it's a longer conversation, will you come back and have that conversation?
I would be pleased to.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Philip Wang is director of the Division of Services and Intervention Research at the National Institute of Mental Health. Coming up, we'll be joined by two more psychiatrists. Both are passionate about recovery. One even uses the word cure from severe mental illness. If you want to join that conversation, the number is 888-477-9499. We're talking about mental illness and its recovery. That's 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY. 91 FM.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Do you have a teenager who suffers from attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD? Are you interested in non-medication treatment for their ADHD? Penn is conducting a research study with an investigational magnetic device to treat ADHD in adolescents and young adults aged 14 to 21. For details, 215-573-8582. 215-573-8582.
On the next Fresh Air, we celebrate our 20th anniversary as a daily national program. It's hard to figure out which interviews we could play that might sum up 20 years. So we're going to bring our producers into the studio to choose Fresh Air moments they remember and play them back for us. Join us for the celebration.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
And welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about recovery from severe mental illness today, what it means, and what can make that happen. Joining me now are Drs. Lauren Crabtree and Daniel Fisher. Lauren Crouchy is a psychiatrist, the co-founder of Project Transition here in Pennsylvania, where he's the medical director. It's a very unique and effective program with six branches in our region. We're going to hear lots more about it. Lauren, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, Dan.
I'm also joined by Daniel Fisher. He's a co-director of the National Empowerment Center, member of the President's New Freedom Commission on Mental Health. He's also has a PhD in biochemistry, and he's carried out neurochemical research at the National Institute of Mental Health. Daniel Fisher, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Dan.
I want to start off with that language. Like any researcher, I Googled you, and I got your bio, and one of the opening statements on your bio is, Dan has recovered from schizophrenia. That's
correct.
Recovered is a pretty unusual word to be used right next to the word schizophrenia.
Well, and it turns out I'm not an anomaly. There's a myth that's been perpetuated really for over 100 years that people diagnosed with mental illness do not recover. And it goes back actually to the days of the late 1800s. Emil Kraepelin divided all of his patients in the hospital into two groups. And those that recovered, he said, had affective disorders, mood swings, depression, manic depression. And those that didn't recover, he called them dementia precox, which later became called schizophrenia. So from the very beginning, it was a condition from which people were told they would never recover. And unfortunately, that still is told to people today.
Do you believe anyone with schizophrenia can be cured, can recover?
They can recover. I don't really use the word cure, by the way. I heard that in the early part of your...
That was my mistake.
That's okay. We use the term recovery because we see it as much broader than a medical condition. We see it as mind, body, and spirit together.
So if you don't mind, mm-hmm. how old were you when you had the diagnosis, and what happened? What did it mean to have schizophrenia?
Well, I was first hospitalized when I was 24. Actually, I was just turning 25. And I had, at that point, ironically, spent a year doing research at the National Institute of Mental Health on the biological and chemical basis of schizophrenia. And as I say, there was some irony. I then myself was diagnosed with schizophrenia. And the first diagnosis was actually brief psychotic reaction, maybe schizophreniform. Then a year later, at the age of 26, I was in the hospital for 6 months, and six Navy psychiatrists diagnosed me with schizophrenia, and I was discharged on a disability.
Were they right?
Well, I fit the criteria, and this is actually a question that people ask today. People today say, well, if you have, you know, become a psychiatrist and led a relatively healthy life, you must not have had schizophrenia. So I've actually had to defend, never thought I would have to, had to defend a diagnosis.
It's a funny world we live
in.
It is
a very funny world. And so it actually happened recently. A friend of mine was taking an abnormal psychology course at Boston University, and the professor said, well, people never recover from schizophrenia. And she said, well, a friend of mine has. And he said, well, I don't believe it. So she called me up, and I said, okay, let's go through the DSM-4. And I actually had all the criteria that are in the DSM-4 for schizophrenia.
For example, I needed it.
I did go into another reality. I'm not keen on some of the language. It is described as delusions. I tend to think of them as an overly active imagination as a way to try to solve problems in my life. I believe the television was talking to me, and I really did believe it. But now I understand it in a way that I was emotionally remote from myself and the people around me. And I was unable to work in my chosen profession for 6 months as a psychiatrist. As a biochemist. And I also had pretty much an absence of affect. In fact, when I was admitted to the hospital, I was mute and was really pretty much unable or unwilling to talk. I can't really remember which. But I was in that condition for about the first month of my hospitalization.
I am struck by your second criteria, your vision of delusions as an active imagination trying to solve problems. And boy, that can be said by good old garden variety neurotics like my very self. I mean, we do that too. I guess it's quantitatively different.
Yeah, it's just that mine, I never was one for half measures. And I don't put myself in the same category with Albert Einstein, but I was just reading some of his biography, and they said he would work on one problem for years with a single-minded determination. And that makes a good scientist, and I was a very good scientist.
Well, this is also sounds like John Nash, too.
A little bit, yeah. I was actually at Princeton the same time he was, but I didn't meet him.
Let me turn to you, Lauren Crabtree, because I know your vision of mental illness is certainly not traditional, down-the-middle vision. What's your reaction to what you're hearing from Daniel Fisher, who's suggesting that recovery is not only possible, it's probable?
Well, Dan, it's great to hear your voice.
Yeah, hello, Lauren.
I'm sitting here, of course, with admiration, as I always am when I hear you speak. And I love the way you're languaging this experience. It's just terrific. I have a problem of nuance around the word recovered. You see how easy it was for Dan to say cured, even though that he understands that isn't what you had in mind, and I know that too. But a lot of persons that we work with that have, say, that are stuck in non-ordinary reality don't have the good fortune that you had, and even yours took quite a while. So a lot of the focus of my work really is on what kind of social system or environment or community can we invite someone that's on this voyage to recovery, the best life they can live. And so that's really, and that really takes into account not those who experience that they have recovered and resume a life, but those who have modest to moderate good control of their symptoms but can't.
Your vision, Lauren, sounds not unlike an addiction model.
Maybe, but yes, aspects of it, like in recovery and addiction, folks will say, well, I started drinking when I was 15, therefore when I am now sober, I have to go back to being age 15 and learn again, for the first time, I mean, how to become an adult. If you took that particular piece, then I would say yes, because that's the heart of our work.
I
would like to make a comment on that.
Please.
And Lauren, I certainly agree with a lot of what you're saying. There are differing paths, I would say, of people's recovery. I'm particularly interested recently in the developmental aspects.
Yeah, that's what I'm sort of meaning.
Yeah, I very much believe, and from my own experience and those that people that I work with and my other consumer leaders, we do tend to use the word, by the way, mental health consumer or survivor, but because we don't like to be called mental patients. But the developmental aspect, I think socially, most everyone that I have come across and in analyzing my own life sort of trajectory has involved a interruption in our social and emotional development.
Right.
And not necessarily by substances, although substances can play a role, but it is a parallel, I think, to the substance abuse. And I think trauma plays a very significant role. And I think that's starting to be highlighted more. But in the broadest sense of trauma being any circumstances or events or relationships that interfere with one's capacity to develop as a full adult.
You've said, Daniel, that one of the most important factors in recovery is belief that you can recover.
Absolutely. I think that might be one of the most important. And almost everyone, we've done research into recovery, basically qualitative research of interviewing people who've shown significant or complete recovery, and from schizophrenia in particular, since it's considered that people don't. And to almost every single person said there was somebody along the way who believed in them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've heard exactly the same thing from anyone who's recovered from almost any trauma.
Yeah.
You know, who's come off the streets, they appear just at that time. But this business of belief that one can recover, I think my concern, I don't know if you're aware of this, but I'm a quadriplegic.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
One of my concerns is that, you know, many of my cohorts, when I was in the hospital many years ago, went home believing that one day they'd walk again, and it ruined their lives, mm-hmm. that kind of belief. So it's the image of what recovery means is terribly important.
Well, I'm glad you raised this, Dan, because I do a lot of work with cross-disability, the cross-disability movement. In fact, Justin Dart was one of my best friends, and I admired tremendously the work that he did, and Fred Fay and others in the independent living movement. And I see a very strong parallel between independent living and recovery. And that's why I don't talk about cure also. But recovery, as I see it, is really having control over your life, the fundamental decisions of your life, and be able to make choices that really fulfill a meaningful work and meaningful love. And that doesn't mean that you become a standardized chemical entity. And maybe some of us have a slightly different chemistry, but thank heavens we do.
Yeah, it also doesn't mean your definition doesn't have much to do with symptoms.
No, exactly. Actually, we do veer away from the idea of symptoms. You may have heard me say about my imagination was an attempt to solve problems. That actually is borrowed a bit from Alfred Adler, who believed that every symptom was an attempt to solve a problem. And I'm very, I think that makes a lot of sense when I look back on it. I was filling in my life with missing people. Like another so-called symptom is, and John Nash had this in his in Beautiful Mind, you may have seen it, ideas of reference. The idea that, you know, there were hidden signals out there for you. And I see that as a lack of meaning, that I was suffering from a meaning deficit disorder, I would say.
And, you know, it's interesting. When we back away from labels like thoughts of reference, when we back away from schizophrenia, when you describe it as finding meaning in things where there apparently is none, well, you know, we hear this in a large percentage of our population who find meaning in the way the sun rises on a particular day, that, you know, it's a message from whoever it's a message from.
There's this whole sort of movement around something called The Secret. I was talking to a woman on the plane. I get a lot of sort of my material from talking to people on airplanes. Because every person is another wealth of stories. And I told her about my work, and she said, it sounds like The Secret, which I really hadn't learned that much about. I'm starting to read about it, but apparently it is about this idea that you put out something, and then it's there for you.
And it's kind of meaning-making.
That's right.
Kind of what you described. Before we've got to take a break in just a couple of minutes, but I want to hear about your empowerment model, how it differs from the traditional medical model.
Well, yeah, how long do we have? I would call it empowerment model of recovery and development, by the way. I'm sort of very keen on the idea that our development, as it progresses, moves more and more into our own hands, and that we play an increasing role in our development. And the decisions that we make have a huge impact on our future. And so I do feel that we have some responsibility. It is different from the medical model. I was interested in your interview with Dr. Wang, because I myself was a biochemist at NIMH a number of years ago. And the thinking still in the medical realm is still, the language of it is so disturbing to me as a person who's recovered or working with people recovering. The medical model tends to emphasize words like intervention or adherence to regimens or treatment program. And I heard very little mention about the person's own sense of self or their efficacy or the decisions and responsibility that a person can make. And ironically and sadly, this medicalization of psychiatric problems has actually turns out increased, not decreased, the stigma. Excellent research by John Reed in Australia has shown that when people are taught that model versus a psychosocial developmental model, that with the medical model, they say they wouldn't want their daughter marrying one of those people, and they wouldn't want them working next to them. And I think it's because the medical model implies or suggests that the person will never gain a modicum of control over their own life or over their own recovery. And we really do emphasize that people can gain some increasing control, not complete control. No one has complete control. But through relationships and building relationships of meaning and love, people can actually gain increasing control over their own lives.
Lauren, you're doing a lot of body language over there, a lot of head bobbing.
Yeah.
So it looks like you agree with...
It's wonderful what Dan is describing. Thank you again, Dan. It fits so our vision at Project Transition. I never qualified as a victim or stricken one, mm-hmm. although I would argue in private circles that if a person has failed two psychoanalyses for a total of 7 years, who's to judge one's pain? But I just didn't have that. I did have a drive in residency to get folks better, as I thought was my role as a growing psychiatrist, and was ineffective. And as I developed other ideas, partly based on my own sense of my own growth or development, really surrounded sense of alienation and stuff like that, although I perform well, there's no question about it, attain high standards and goals and achievements. So when we started with Project Transition, though we really only started to help a single person, not as a program, we used the biological model big time and still do. But I always knew it was insufficient for many. In fact, we say, don't come to us if all you need's a pill, for gosh sakes, because our focus is in the presence of your journey. Can we turn attention to a better life on your terms of meaning and purpose, away from the tyranny of illness and its treatments? And that has to do with relationships and belonging and all the things that Dan is saying about inviting folks to entertain the possibility of self-managing, whether they're called symptoms or interferences, self-managing treatments so that they know how to manage that tyranny, and also to invest in a sense, an abundance of relationship opportunities and sense of belonging, which we think is the heart of recovery.
We've got to go to break, and when we come back, I want to talk more specifics about your program, Lauren. But I want to underscore something both of you are saying, language you're both using, which almost never gets used when we're talking about major mental disorders. You're using language of relationships, of belonging. Dan, you used the word love two or three times so far since you've been on, and that mm-hmm. word almost never gets used in this context, as though it's less important for someone who has a major mental disorder. It's quite a sad and poignant commentary. We'll be back after a short break. We're talking about mental illness, its treatment, its recovery, what needs to be done. We're taking a bigger look at mental illness beyond the brain. My guests are Lauren Crabtree and Daniel Fisher. Crabtree's a psychiatrist. He's co-founder of Project Transition here in Pennsylvania. Dan Fisher is co-director of the National Empowerment Center. He's a member of the President's New Freedom Commission. on mental health. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Penn supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit are providing evaluations to determine if you are suffering from depression. Symptoms may include mood swings, irritability, sleep disturbance, and lack of interest. Those who qualify may receive an initial examination and treatment with an investigational antidepressant for 3 to 12 months. For information, the DRU number at Penn is 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
Next time on Day to Day.
This bridge is no place to call home.
But new laws in Florida leave some people with few options.
Everyone here is on probation. You have sexual offenders and sexual predators all together at once.
Police keep an eye on them, but where are the other sex offenders living?
They haven't left the state. They just went underground. We don't know where they are.
Tougher laws and a new problem.
This is in no one's best interest.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about mental illness, what it is, recovery, and how it's done, what works, what doesn't work. My guests are Drs. Daniel Fisher and Lauren Crabtree. Fisher is Executive Director of the National Empowerment Center, and he's a psychiatrist who has recovered from schizophrenia. Crabtree is also a psychiatrist, co-founder and medical director of Project Transition in Pennsylvania. We've got lots of people on the line who want to join the conversation. We'll get to those lines in just a minute. Lauren, I love the story you tell about the beginning of Project Transition 25 years ago.
Oh, my. I'll try to be brief. I love to tell it because a lot of folks, now that we have six branches, think of us as a business, as a company, and so it is, has become. But when it started, we had no, when I say we, a group of colleagues, private hospital, working in those days, 25 years ago, long-term, state-of-the-art. I could do everything and anything. And my folks that left beautifully, and then many didn't make it. And so we started to try to figure out, if we looked at our data, that everyone did so well, can we account for why so many didn't once they were out? And what we found was the world of what Dan is calling the developmental issues or what have you, skill areas. So it totally revolutionized both our inpatient, and then from that, realizing that that was no place to learn to live, to the development of what became Project Transition. It started only because in a family session, we all agreed that this young adult, if he went home, was going to lose his gains. Everyone agreed, no scapegoating. We all loved each other totally, but it was clear. And we couldn't find any service for him, waiting list for a year in the community. So the father happened to have some money, and he took out a check and wrote me a check. And we went out and rented an apartment for his son and another fella to help only them. And we, you know, we hired one of our most enthusiastic persons that was his same age to big brother or co-brother him with the stated aim. Yes, I mean, we took for granted it, that treatment would go on, but we also knew that was insufficient. How to help this guy make it in his living. And that was the beginning. Before you know it, others started wanting this, and before you know it, we had a small enough group to say, hey, maybe we should see if there's some common needs, and started really, I guess, what's now called the world of psychosocial rehab, psychoed, and recovery interventions.
You teach practical skills.
Sure. Oh, yeah, big time.
What are the skills? How do you teach them?
Well, what we do is, if you take a group of adults, I mean, if anyone says, look, I don't want to get a job, I want to play piano, so then you go play piano. But a lot of folks, we're in some instances thought of often as a, quote, last resort effort, because they're so counterintuitive, unfortunately, in this day and age. But a lot of our folks want a job. So if that's true, then could we construct a meaningful group in which we work together on that, say, around that theme? A lot of our folks face that they want richer relationships, even though they have them at Project Transition without any additional skills. They want more. And so why not see if there's any, it's not, these are not coercive things, they're totally voluntary. Why not see if we can be effective teaching, in other words, ordinary life skills?
I want to underscore that, and Dan, I want you to pick up on this theme. You have said that one of the major deficits of the people you work with is relationship difficulties, that they have trouble belonging.
Right.
Which is almost, no, I wouldn't say almost, which is essential for well-being in this.
Absolutely.
In this culture. You agree with that, Dan?
Oh, yeah. Oh, from my own life experience, from those that we've interviewed who've been going through their recovery, from people that I've seen for 30 years in counseling as their therapist, it's almost always about, I mean, Lauren makes it sound deceptively simple. life, it's about those little things about life that if you don't pick them up growing up, and I don't blame parents, by the way. I'm a parent myself. I have a 22 and 24-year-old, two daughters, and I know how complex parenting is and that we are not the only social influence in our kids' lives, but there are so many things to pick up so quickly. But especially, I am very fascinated and curious about how people come to understand what other people are thinking and feeling and what they themselves are thinking and feeling.
I had a powerful experience about 2 months ago. I was talking to a bunch of high school kids, and like all high school kids, they were complaining of stress in their family. And All of them said that their parents were under great stress. And I asked them what they wanted for their family, and they all said, well, I want my parents to take better care of their lives. Uh-huh. But a lot of them said, I want my parents to open up to me, to tell me what's going on in their hearts. And when I left, I thought about, well, yeah, they're asking for role models for intimacy.
That is interesting.
Nobody's ever taught them about intimacy, and we're not doing that in family.
I have my daughters. I'm very proud of them. They're sort of like, especially my older daughter, a little bit like they want to tell their friends, her friends, that I've recovered from schizophrenia. And in college, she would say this to her friends, and I'd say to her, "You think that's a really good idea to, you know, bring that up, you know, right away or early on?" And I said, "What do they think about that?" And she said, "They think that's so wonderful." And they would call me, some of her friends who wanted to talk, you know, and they wanted to hear, how did I recover? And I think it's because they also don't hear from their parents about their parents' own struggles.
Right.
And I have been pretty open with my kids. Fortunately, I haven't had a major breakthrough since they've really been born, but I have described to them, and we have a pretty good relationship. My older daughter said, "Why were you so old when I was born? I was 38. She said, "You could have been my grandfather." And I said, "Well, you wouldn't have wanted me as a parent when I was in my 20s. And she said, "Oh, that's right. You were crazy then." So we do talk about it, and we talk about the fact that I did marijuana and drugs and that I didn't find it was a good idea, but not everybody's perfect.
Let's see if we can squeeze a phone call on. We've had a lot of people waiting online for a long time. Let's go to Gail. Gail, hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, I am a mom of a 34-year-old. Paranoid schizophrenic, diagnosed about 10 years ago. I'm also a registered nurse and work in a state hospital, psychiatric hospital. My question is mostly for Daniel Fisher. I wonder if you could speak to kind of the catch-22 of denial and lacking insight so that my son could get to more of a path of recovery?
Great, great question, Gail.
It's a very good question. And my first answer to that is that if you're described, if your condition, as mine was, is described as a hopeless condition, I'm not saying necessarily doctors or, you know, therapists have said this about your friend, your son, but in our society, unfortunately, the diagnosis of schizophrenia still does carry that weight with it, then perhaps in some ways it's good sense not to have insight into a hopeless, thinking you have a hopeless condition. I believe that if there were a new understanding that many people show significant, and almost everybody can show probably some recovery, even from schizophrenia, that there'd be much more hope, people would feel much more hopeful, and there'd be more insight, so that you wouldn't feel like you had to look inside and say, I have a hopeless condition, but would look inside and say, I see, I've met some other people who've been through this, and I perhaps can show some improvement myself, too. And I hope that there'll be more opportunity for people who've been through experiences like myself to really share our story with other people. Now, I'll just, a very quick little vignette. There was a 13-year-old that came to a talk that I gave in Oregon recently, and he squirmed around the whole morning, and I thought, this is not really getting anywhere. He was one of maybe 100 people in the audience. His mother came up at lunchtime and said, I said, did your son get anything from that? And she said, I think you saved his life. And I said, what do you mean? She said, when he was 10, he was told he had bipolar disorder, and he was told he'd have it the rest of his life. He'd always take medication, and he really shouldn't have too many ambitions in life.
And at the deepest, deepest level, you are probably the most important teacher there is. Unfortunately, we've got to go. I'd love to chat with both of you for another hour. My guests have been Lauren Crabtree and Daniel Fisher. Crabtree is a psychiatrist. He's co-founder of Project Transition, and you can find him at projecttransition.com. Fisher is executive director of the National Empowerment Center. On Wednesday, June 13th, there'll be a special in the spirit of family. My panel and I are going to discuss monitoring media, MySpace, and communication with youth today. For more information about that, log into whyy.org. Well, you can reach us at the same address, voices@hyy.org. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Bob Purdick. Shane Ewing's our intern. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Elisa Walters is our associate producer, who is enjoying her birthday today. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friend.